Earlier this fall, a Lawrence teen was officially appointed to serve on the city's Sustainability Advisory Board. That's an advisory group formed to identify actions the city can take to address climate change, reduce food waste, a lot of stuff like that. The goal is to reach a 100% renewable energy status. I'd just like to reiterate, she's a teenager. She's 16. And it was her vast experience as an outspoken proponent of environmental sustainability that inspired city government officials to champion her involvement. She's being called the Greta Thunberg of Lawrence, Kansas. But unlike Greta, her efforts for now are local. It's about what can be done right here to stop what she calls the destruction of our planet by humans. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're pleased to introduce Morgan Orozco to Kansas City. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I want to start by saying I know you kind of take issue with that comparison to Greta, despite profound respect for her. Can you explain that?
Yeah, definitely. So I feel like Greta obviously is someone that I look up to a lot. She's incredible. Her speaking abilities are incredible. And I mean, what she's done, the movements that she started, is just mind-blowing. Like, at that age, to see someone changing the world on that level is outstanding. However, I think that it's sort of not necessarily bad, but a little bit of a flawed perspective to compare us, because I feel like my actions are, very different from the scale of hers. So they're not necessarily different in intention, because obviously we both care deeply about environmental protection and saving humanity, which is currently on its course to destruction. However, I think that my actions are more locally based, I guess, and I like to focus more on getting the community and municipal operations to really focus on how can we as a city begin to thoroughly protect our environment and ensure that we're doing everything in our power to combat climate change. So
you are in high school. What year
Yes.
are you?
I'm a junior. I'm 16.
And you've been on the Sustainability Advisory Board for the City of Lawrence since October. What has that been like? Because I imagine your peers are quite a bit older than you.
They are. It's been an incredible experience. Honestly, I'm like roughly 2 months in, I think, and it's been a lot of learning. There have been some things that I've had experience with before, such as parliamentary procedure. That wasn't really new to me because of clubs at school, quite honestly.
Yeah, I want to explore that. Parliamentary procedure, not new to you as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, I participate in, I'm the president of my Young Dems chapter at my school, as well as an officer in our Future Business Leaders of America chapter. And also I participate in Model United Nations, all clubs that use parliamentary procedure. And so I'm familiar with all the different aspects of that.
Yeah, and so you were just telling me about what it's been like for you to be 2 months into your role on this advisory board.
Yeah, it's been a lot of learning about the different nuances of city policy and how everything has to be considered before making a decision. Like, it's really been fascinating to see, like, okay, when we're discussing this specific ordinance, how is this going to affect other aspects of city life? How is this going to affect other policies, different lifestyles, and just, I guess, everything in the city exterior to what that ordinance is discussing. So, like looking at like economic effects and stuff like that. So,
what inspired you to get involved, not just in like a school club or picking up trash on a weekend or something, but officially as part of the city government?
Yeah. Well, one of the people that was really influential in me getting on the advisory board was the city commission candidate, Joey Hensler, because he was the one who actually recommended that I apply for an advisory board. Obviously, I've been advocating for youth civic engagement as part of my Kansas High School Dems organization, which I'm vice chair of. We're big advocates for young people getting involved on the city level and state level with politics and policy, because we think that's really important. And so
important
climate change,
why? Just before you continue on from there.
It's important, I feel like, because the youth, we're inherently disenfranchised because we lack the same number of years alive, which I feel is kind of silly because
disenfranchised
years do not...
in a literal sense, you don't have the vote.
Yeah, we don't have the vote, and also people don't regard our perspectives as the same, like, level of importance as other people's. And I think that's what I kind of take contention with. I feel like that's kind of silly because even though we lack the same number of years on this planet, we make up a large portion of the population, obviously, and our perspective, our experience is still very important to policymaking because obviously it's part of the population and everyone should get a voice regardless of age, regardless of gender, regardless of race. Like, everyone is equal. I hold the firm belief that every single human being is inherently equal from the moment that they're born. And I think that the youth is one portion of the population that doesn't really have the same voice.
So do you really, you think that there's like should be no cutoff age? Because I can think back in my own just sort of like mental development to an age where a color of a leaflet might persuade me that that's the best candidate. Like not a recent time in my own development.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, a 5-year-old might do that. And I know it doesn't sound to me like you probably are advocating a vote for 5-year-olds. But if I guess, yeah, just could you clarify a little bit what your vision would be then?
Uh-huh. I'm definitely not advocating for a vote for 5-year-olds necessarily. But I do think that teens specifically, especially with the rise of social media, our presence on the internet, and how much information we absorb every day from social media posts specifically about like social justice movements and stuff like that. I think that it's really important that we have a say because we're experiencing the effects of policy just as much as anyone else. We're experiencing what the government decides to do just as much as any other citizen. It's just our voice isn't heard. And so I think that's really unfair. And so teens specifically in this day and age, in this rapidly changing society where we've become so absorbed in technology, I think that we definitely still deserve that voice because we have this information in front of us. And I've yet to meet a teen that doesn't have some shred of political ideology. And so I think that us having a voice is very important. So
you had been advocating for youth involvement in city government, and someone in city government urged you to apply for this position on the Sustainability Advisory Board.
He kind of just recommended generally that I apply for an advisory board or committee. And so it was sort of my I was just like, okay, so what do I care about? And obviously, I'm super outdoorsy. I've spent my entire life, like, hanging out outside. I really enjoy, like, hiking, backpacking, camping, all that. That's sort of my vibe. And so I think that was really what led me to choose the Sustainability Advisory Board to apply to because I care a lot about the planet and environmental protection. We feel how imminent this problem is. And so I chose the Sustainability Advisory Board to apply to because having a youth perspective on that board would be very valuable.
Do you remember the first time you really consciously thought about what is going on with the environment and had a strong reaction to it? I guess I'm asking whether you can recall the very first stirrings of this passion of yours.
So I'm from Florida and I care about the ocean a lot because I mean we go back all the time to Florida. I spend a lot of my time on the beach when we go back. And so I remember when I was little, I would always, when we came home from the grocery store, I would always put like the soda bottles or the soda cans in the fridge. And you know, they have that plastic packaging around them. I was probably like in like first grade or something. And I was taking that off. And my mom was actually like, you know, people throw those things in the ocean and they actually start choking marine wildlife like turtles and stuff. And I think that is just when it clicked for me, like any form of human interaction that's negative with the environment, if we affect it in a negative way at all, that's absolutely not okay because it's our habitat, it's the planet we live on, but it's also the habitat for so many other species. And they
Who definitely don't have a say.
Yeah, who definitely don't have a say.
Take me on the journey with you from being a 6 or so year old learning about what packaging around soda cans does to marine life to being someone who is taking action and really getting the support of your community.
So I think I've sort of grown to be a lot more action-oriented. I think that when I was younger, and actually
younger
more so
than 16.
Now, yeah, more so now, but a lot of what I see in adults, and this is obviously no offense to adults, but
none
this,
taken.
a lot of what I see is a lot of talk and not enough action. And so that's sort of a consistency throughout my life. So, I mean, I was probably in like third grade when the discussion of climate change began in schools. I mean, it was just like a little bit of it. And I was like, okay, that's kind of atrocious. Like people, like carbon emissions in our atmosphere that are warming the planet and leading us all to our inevitable demise, that's also not okay. And so I think my concern was a lack of action because I didn't see action happening. I wasn't hearing anything about anyone genuinely trying to make that change. When it really clicked for me was when I started hearing people say, well, yeah, I don't want to have children because I don't want to bring kids onto this planet when we're racing towards our impending doom. And I think that...
Do you hear people your age saying that?
Yes, I hear it frequently because there are so many, among other issues in society, I think it's really absolutely our imperative as human beings that we try to at least reverse this problem because it's going to massively affect future generations and our children and ourselves. And I think the imminence of that is felt uniquely by young people. So,
yeah, as far as the Greta comparison goes, she has admirers around the globe.
Yeah.
She also has people mocking her and putting her down and trying to discredit her worldwide. And I wonder how that hits you, because despite your differences, mm-hmm. I would think that seeing how people treat her could intimidate some young people from getting out there and talking about all this stuff in a similar way.
I kind of have a similar, I mean, obviously not on the same scale, but I don't think that being rude to someone that's trying to help you is not okay in any way, because one of the things I say a lot is to people who don't believe in climate change, I say, okay, well, if you don't believe in climate change, then what's the harm in trying to help our planet? Because regardless, we're still emitting tons of carbon into our atmosphere, which is not good for a plethora of reasons. We're throwing plastic into our oceans, not
like
okay.
Maybe you don't want asthma.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that
just for the sake of keeping the planet clean, you're saying...
Yeah, I think that regardless of whether or not you believe in climate change, action is still necessary. But also, on top of that, the negativity received by Greta, I've sort of felt on a very much smaller scale paralleled. Like, for instance, like Facebook comments or like Lawrence Journal World comments that are just like negative, like, oh, she's just a teen. She's ignorant for believing in climate change. I've received a lot of those sort of that sort of feedback. And I mean, it doesn't really hit me because I don't, to be quite honest, I don't really care about people's opinions. I mean, my priority is trying to save the planet and humanity from its impending demise. And so those opinions aren't really like relevant to me for that reason. But I did spend a good portion of time worrying about that because these are people that think that action should not be taken. And if action isn't taken, then we're obviously going to have to face the suffering and the destruction that comes with climate change.
So you aren't bothered by it for like it stings kinds of reasons. You're bothered by it because those people aren't contributing to the solution.
Exactly. And that's what worries me, because I think I spent a solid like hour just laying in the dark. I was just like, okay, this is a crisis, and there are actually people out there that don't believe that climate change is a thing.
You have you know, a more general interest in political involvement, like we've talked about. And I understand that it's gotten to the point where there's a joke among your friends that's also kind of not a joke about 2048.
Oh, yes. My presidential run. Okay. I really want to go into some form of public service. I think that I sort of have defined my purpose in life as to help people. When I think about like my existential being, when I think about what my purpose is as a human being, I'm like, okay, well, I have to benefit society in some way. And I'm going to do that by being part of like public service and government work.
I'm going to jump in and say that we are talking during impeachment hearings. It is a volatile time in national politics. And there's a lot of what many would see as corruption playing out before all of our eyes. Does that affect how you imagine a future in politics?
I want to sort of reiterate like the point that George Washington made about how partisanship and having two parties is not really a solution to the problems that we have. I do think that working together instead of viewing it as like a war over political capital is like the way to go, because I mean, the purpose of the government is to take care of the population. And if we are constantly battling due to political differences and partisanship, and when I say partisanship, I don't even necessarily mean political parties. I just mean like parties in the sense that there are two different sides of the situation and everyone wants what they want. Exactly. And they're like very opposed to compromise. I see a lot of flaws with that. And I want to change that. So,
right now, you are focused locally. And I wonder what actions you do see a city having the capacity to take to bring about real change on specifically climate and environment issues that are global. What actions are you pushing for, Lawrence?
So we're actually working on this renewable energy plan that right now in the Sustainability Advisory Board, which I encourage anyone listening to look up, because we have this document that's like compiled lots of information on the existence of climate change and how we can do our part as a city to prevent it. And so I think what we have right now in the document is a goal to make the city have 100% renewable energy by 2050. And that includes like citizens and municipal operations. And so that is subject to change because we have discussed making that date sooner, which I definitely think should be sooner because the problem is obviously imminent. It's happening now. Also, the Metro KC Climate Action Coalition, it's a really long name. It's possible I got that wrong, but having the city join that, they have a bunch of like recommended policies for the city to adopt.
I wanted to ask you about that. There is this push for a Green New Deal resolution in Kansas City. The local Sunrise Movement is expected to demand, as part of the upcoming climate strike, that Mayor Quentin Lucas and the city council adopt that resolution. And it would make us the first major Midwestern city to have something like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's really important because if cities on the local level don't make change, I mean, the federal government can't do it all for us. The reason we have a local, state, and federal government is so we can, like, divide the power and ensure that different, like, policies are allocated to different portions of the government. And I think that it's important for every single level of government to take action. So even though I think that federal government action against climate change is important, I think that local government and state government action is possibly even more important because that's where real change, like tangible change, can occur.
Something I struggle with personally, and I think a lot of us do, is, you know, you consume an apocalyptic sounding news report about the environment, and then you somehow have to transition back into living your normal life, going about your day. You know, it can be overwhelming to the point of, why make the bed? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
You seem to be very on top of your life, despite looking at this very scary issue head on constantly every day. Any advice for people who are not doing so well at reconciling all of that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that obviously climate change and mental health go hand in hand. It's really easy as an activist or any citizen that cares about climate change to fall into this like gloom and doom perspective. But to that, I would say maintain your hope. Not all hope is lost. I think that as long as we continue to advocate for action against climate change and for environmental protection, change can occur. We just have to push even harder. We have to speak out even louder. And I think that we really have to hold people in government and like CEOs of corporations, the people that are that can really make a massive change because they have the luxury of having that power. We have to hold them accountable for their actions. And if we don't do so, I mean, that's when we have this like gloom and doom sort of thing happening. But and also take care of yourself, I would say, because I actually recently I went to a meeting of Kansas Women's Environmental Network. I'm speaking at their next meeting. So they invited me to their meeting in it was either October or November. But basically, one person there was talking about climate change activism and mental health. And I think that one really big part of making change is you have to make sure that you're healthy first. And so I sort of remind myself of that every day. I'm like, okay, if I want to take care of the planet, the first step to doing that is taking care of myself, ensuring that I'm healthy, ensuring that like I am getting enough sleep to function.
Okay. Before we go, I do want to say something to you as like an obnoxious grown-up, which is that during our mic check, you said that all you'd had for breakfast was coffee and that you don't have much time to sleep, which I just want to say you need your sleep, young lady.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that the route that I sort of take when it comes to sleep is so today is a busy day. Last night was an exception. Later in the day, I actually am speaking on another panel for Kansas Farmers Union. And so admittedly, last night I did not get as much sleep as I probably should. But I think that making up for it in taking care of yourself in other ways, ensuring that you're happy, like taking a little like second. I have this thing called the happy light that I turn on every morning that like produces vitamin D and it like emulates what the sun is. And I just turn my happy light on and that sort of wakes me up. And so even if I'm not getting enough sleep, I think just taking care of yourself in any way possible is really a priority. Because if you want to make change, you have to ensure that you're healthy yourself first.
So. Morgan Orozco with us from the Sustainability Advisory Board in Lawrence. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Morgan Orozco is a junior in high school. I'm Gina Kaufman. Coming up on KCUR Central Standard, a local artist makes his children's book debut. We'll get that story when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now I'm pleased to introduce a local artist by the name of Charlie Miley. You might have seen him around town doing his pop-up Charlie events where he set up shop in a public space and anyone who passed by could request a drawing of anything they wanted and he would create it. He's also the mastermind behind a lot of the illustrations going up on the walls inside the rabbit hole. That's the ambitious new children's book museum taking shape in North Kansas City under the direction of the folks from the Reading Reptile. But right now, Charlie's here for his big debut of his first children's book, published this week by Farrar Straus Giroux. It's called Something for You, and it's about a mouse. Charlie Miley, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Your book is delightful, which is not a word I generally use, to be honest, but that is exactly what the book is.
Thank you.
How would you describe it? Like, when you're telling people about it, what do you say the book is about?
That's always the hard part. I always say it's about a mouse who's visiting a friend and he finds out that she's sick. And so he goes to start collecting flowers as a gift to make her feel better. But he has to go back empty handed. And I try not to spoil the ending.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I need to say,
spoiler alert.
I think we're going to spoil the ending today. So if anyone is like maybe worried about knowing how it turns out with the mouse and the friendship and everything and the flowers, fair warning.
But so the problem with, for me when I say that, is that it doesn't actually say what the book is about. You know, it describes what the pictures are about and maybe what the plot is, but there's something else there that it's hard for me to describe in a way other than
just showing
the way that I've
book.
Described it, which is the book. So
it is sort of like a hybrid between a traditional children's book and a graphic novel in that the words don't tell the story, pictures do, frame by frame, and you have to follow along looking closely at what's happening in the pictures. The words are what the main character would maybe be saying either to his friend or to himself, but not really to the reader.
Exactly. Yeah, the book was actually wordless when I first came up with it. And part of that is because I wanted readers who didn't maybe know how to read words but could read images. I wanted them to be able to understand it, not only, again, what's happening in the plot, but the emotion. So there's really expressive characters, and the sequencing, I hope, is fairly clear. And comics and the panels are a language that are familiar to me, and it just kind of came naturally to show things that way.
The moral of the story in Something for You is very clear from an adult standpoint. Gifts are nice, but you are enough. Just the love in your heart that someone else can feel. For a kid, especially a little kid, getting that takes quite a bit of work, but like in a good way. Can I tell you about reading this with my 3-year-old?
Oh, please. I'd love to hear that.
Usually when we are done reading a book, one of two things happens. He's ready to move on, or else he says, again. And with your book, something different happened. He needed to go back and study the pictures. He was initially trying to figure out if there was something the mouse could have done differently to not lose the flower. So that's the spoiler. The mouse, the flower blows out of the mouse's hand. And this image, I could feel his energy like next to me, like he was very stressed when we looked at that page, and he needed to go back to it and study it. He was like, you know, maybe he could have held on to it tighter. Maybe he could have raced after it to get it back if he had gone faster or jumped higher or something like that. So I just want to stop with that initial, like the first like experience we had really trying to understand what was happening and what was and wasn't the point about it. And, you know, we had this nice little talk about sometimes you do your best, but things don't go the way you wanted.
Yeah. And I that's the ideal read for me. There's something really important in the message or the solution being a little unclear. Even how you talk, how the language, it's not even sure who's talking or to who, but getting that, putting the idea out there and letting the reader deal with it. And I had never really thought of that, about could he have done something different. There was part of me, well, nature takes its course and there's something bigger that you can't control. And in the spreads that follow, that scene where the flower is flying out of his hands, I think that the mouse main character is dealing with some of those thoughts too. And hopefully that comes across in the illustrations, even though it's, like you said, not necessarily in the words.
Well, so then the next thing we got hung up on was the last flower petal that the mouse managed to get back after the rest of the flower had blown away. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, it was kind of in his collar, as if in all of the hurry, and he had overlooked the smallest one.
Yeah, and there is also the one petal, the one purple petal. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, and this petal has like its own journey.
Yeah, it came from...
which we had to trace.
Yeah.
Frame by frame.
It all goes back to when the mouse started picking flowers and just trying to grasp at anything. I think I really love that spread. There's such a range of emotion of kind of desperation to reach the flowers on the left-hand side, and he kind of moves down the hill, mountain, rocks, whatever it is, and and it's holding this last purple petal, and you don't see it again. He lets it go because it doesn't feel like enough. Like,
yeah,
is this one little part really enough to give to somebody?
Yeah. That page, there is a page where the last petal is dropped down on, like, the city sidewalk, and it looks like this sort of, like, that frame is like this moody movie, like an indie movie, you
yes,
know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, down the side alley, you know?
Well, and someone, when I was showing an early draft of the book, said that it looked like storyboards, the entire book. And I agree, and a lot of the way that I think visually, especially in this book, kind of comes from movie, and even talking about scenes and shots and angle, it's all in the language of having a camera. And even the way that the frames are treated in the book are more dynamic, as if they're pieces of paper placed on the pages of the book.
Okay, so there's just one other thing that we had to work through a little bit, and I need your help on this one. The cake. He was very curious about the cake, and I'm sorry to say, I really didn't have a lot of answers for him. About the cake.
There's
a cake in the book.
What were his questions about the cake?
Well, okay, so his understanding of the moral by the time we had worked through everything was, the gift is the love in my heart and a cake.
And a cake. Well, I think, you know, butter especially is like a perfect expression of love. But that's joking aside, the cake is actually a small concession from, on my part, from an early draft. So the early draft had the mouse coming to visit his friend with a bottle of wine.
And then finding out she's sick.
And finding out she's sick, and that's a totally inappropriate gift for a sick person, so you'd go find something else. And
Maybe it's also an inappropriate gift for the beginning of a children's book.
Yes, and so my editor was like, you know, the wine's got to go. And I was like, no, it's... And then, you know, I couldn't make a strong enough case. She's like, just think of something else. It's not that hard. You're an imaginative person. And so the cake, I figured, is also somewhat of an inappropriate gift for
a
someone
sick
who's
person.
Sick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so yeah, there's this cake. And that was an issue that we had to sort of trace through the book, is like, is the cake still there at the end? And I said, I think so, but
yeah,
it's just
not
in the
room.
Picture.
Yeah. But I love that as the takeaway. It's like, love in your heart and cake. Always make people feel better.
What made you want to create a children's book?
I've been really inspired by other people's work, especially William Steig. I could go on.
Who is he?
William Steig was a New Yorker cartoonist for many, many years. He, in I believe the 60s or 70s, started making children's books in his 60s. Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, Abel's Island, The Real Thief, Spinky Sulks, all these wonderful books. But Abel's Island was the first children's book, or book made for children, and it's a chapter book, that spoke so clearly and directly to me and with respect for me as a reader. Abel gets lost on an island and is kind of stripped of all of his fancy niceties and has to reckon with who he is as a person, quote unquote person. He's a rat or a mouse. And finds out that at the base of it is love and a desire to make art. And so I totally felt that. And so I was exposed to that book at the Reading Reptile, which was run by Pete and Deb, who run the Rabbit Hole, founders of the Rabbit Hole. And that book and then all the books that followed that really just made me want to participate in that conversation and in this great body of work that was so rich
The body of work that is children's literature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is so rich with emotion and some of the most talented artists. And for me, as someone making the books now, I also just love the problems of that are specific to the medium.
What, like what?
So, for instance, books are made in the pages are in multiples of eight because of the printing process. So 32 pages is the standard picture book because it's like the most cost effective for publishers to produce while still, I guess, having enough meat to feel like it's substantial. 40 is common, but so you have to fit your story and all your page turns and all your emotional beats and the plot and the title page and the copyright page. All of that has to fit nicely into this manufacturing structure. And like I said, page turns are a really interesting thing to consider that are specific to picture books. So what happens in that moment, your time is passing when you turn a page. And so what happens in that time? So, and so I get totally lost in that process. I kind of forget that time exists and I forget
that's
to
awesome.
Eat. And so,
I mean, eating is important, but that's awesome.
But so that curiosity and getting to feel that flow is part of what makes me excited to work with books.
You are an illustrator, and I want you to take me on a brief version of the journey of becoming an illustrator, just from your initial fixation to the career you envisioned and eventually how that led to the career you now have.
I think I maybe took a strange route to the career that I have now.
I do get that feeling.
When I was at the Kansas City Art Institute, they didn't have illustration. And drawing, to me at the time, wasn't even a serious activity. So I was doing installations and performances and really exploring all these mediums and more in the conversation of contemporary capital A art.
Yeah, drawing sometimes gets treated as the tool that you use to like get ready to do some other thing.
Yeah, it's never a final expression. Or it's not, I should say it's not never, but it didn't feel that way. And so it was just something I did kind of on the side to make myself feel better and to make notes I left for people nicer. And more I realized that it was part of how I thought, that thinking came much more naturally and was much more cogent when I was drawing. So fast forward all sorts of adventures and brief stints at teaching and landscaping. And I ended up doing Pop-Up Charlie about 6 years ago.
Yeah, explain that. Because that's if people have encountered you and your art making, that's likely how and where.
Exactly. Wait, what was the question? I forgot.
Yeah, explain Pop-Up Charlie.
So Pop-Up Charlie is where I wear a gold cone hat, some gold, and I draw for people on the spot in watercolor and ink, whatever they want. So I started at Missouri Bank, and it snowballed word of mouth. And by just being there, I do a lot of events and parties and public appearances.
Like I could come in and say, I want a giraffe trying to fit inside a thimble, and you'd be like, cool.
Yes. Giraffes are pretty difficult. Like, their legs are extremely strange. But, you know, I've had people say, draw my soul. You know, and that's also, that really gets you thinking.
Yeah.
But,
especially if you just met them.
But the thing about being in gold and in public is that I'm visible. It's the difference between being a guy in a coffee shop that's just drawing to being someone who is providing an art service. And so that visibility is what allowed people to come up and say, well, can you do murals or can you do my logo and can you do this? And so I've gotten to try all sorts of different illustrations to find out what it is I wanted to do.
You know, you mentioned being asked to draw someone's soul, but are there other requests that really stick with you? I am curious what, given, you know, anything, ask me to draw anything, what people ask for.
A lot of them are, you know, me with my pet. And then some people really want to push me and like to combine really random images. The one that has stuck with me the most was at Boulevardia, and it was for someone who I'd drawn for multiple times. So he kind of knew how far he could go and
is he like a groupie?
What would my I wouldn't say groupie, but a fan and a patron. Yes.
Okay. That's the way you say
he
that.
He asked for a piece of toast giving sex advice. And so like you're nodding, like, yes, that is a
yeah, my eyes got kind of wide. At least you started with toast, but I didn't see it go in there.
Yeah. And neither did I when he presented it. So I really took my time with that one to make sure that I got it right. I'll save the rest of that anecdote for anybody that wants to talk about it privately.
Well, as I mentioned, you are working on The Rabbit Hole, the children's book museum taking shape in North Kansas City. It's a big deal. What can you tell us about how it's going and your role in making it something special from a visual artistic standpoint?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yes.
So The Rabbit Hole is a nonprofit children's literature museum that is going to provide an immersive storytelling experience for children and adults. We want to bring stories to life. And so to do that, things are going to be to scale from the story so you can sit with Frog and Toad, to making them interactive so that you get to participate in the story. And every exhibit gets its own treatment because every story needs to be told in its own way.
And you're sort of the artist in residence working on that?
Well, I've been an illustrator with them kind of from the beginning. I did the logo and I've done a lot of the brand work. Now I'm doing a lot of the conceptual drawings and trying to bring that vision to life and fill in people's imagination.
And that's where your book release is going to be. Charlie Miley, author of Something for You, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
The family event celebrating Charlie's new book has sold out, but there's an adults-only party Friday night that is also sold out. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be back with one last thing for today. 800 Tubas. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And real quick, I want to tell a story about how Kansas City became a place where hundreds of tubas come together every Christmas, and Kansas City's resulting claim to a world record for number of tubas performing in one place at one time. It's all happening at Tuba Christmas, and here to talk about it is Stephanie Brimhals. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You are the education director for the Kansas City Symphony. You were also the coordinator for the effort last year to snag that world record for Tuba Christmas, which was successful. How does that work?
It is a multi-step process. First, we were hosting the event, and we've been hosting it for a long time and knew that we had the numbers. So we, about a year in advance of last year's record, we started planning and got in contact with Guinness, and it happened.
So you won
with
800 tubas playing Silent Night?
835 tubas.
835?
That's right.
Dang. I'm interested in the song selection because Silent Night is not a big noise. And in fact, like the word silent is in the name of the song. It's like a quiet sounding song by design. And you picked that to gather 800 tubas together and break a world record for like volume.
So there was some strategy behind that. So we do all of the so many different Christmas carols as part of this event. And Silent Night, when you get that many tuba players together, it is a big noise. So part of the strategy was having a song that was going to be palatable to the ear. So when you heard
so you didn't leave with like ear damage.
Exactly. Yes. So we also, part of the record process was we had to play something for 5 full minutes. So for it to count as toward the actual record. So we picked a song that we thought people would want to listen to for 5 straight minutes as well.
Fair enough. I understand you have competition for this world record in Texas, which is amazing to me that there are competing tuba ensembles.
True. So, I mean, there are Tuba Christmas is a national organization. So there are Tuba Christmas event all across the country every year. Last year, it's my understanding that there was a group in Texas that was also going for the Guinness record. They went for it shortly before we did. Their process was a little bit different than ours. We had a Guinness adjudicator at our event, so we were able to determine in that moment that we actually did break the record. I think the group in Texas were in the process of submitting all of their documents after they finished it. I know that they had more than the original record of 502, but they did not have more than 835. So we still hold it.
Are you intimidated by the knowledge that there are others out there trying to unseat you?
I think a year later, no, not as much. in the moment, it was a little terrifying because so much work goes into it. And, you know, these players, when they get there, they're so excited to be there. They love playing the tuba. It was so exciting for those guys to, like, be a part of this record that I felt nervous for them that it wasn't going to happen. Now it's more of, you know what, if people want to try and break it, and that's going to make more people excited about playing the tuba and listening to an ensemble of tuba players, have at it. That's great.
Why gather hundreds of tuba players together?
That is an excellent question. So Tuba Christmas started 46th year of Tuba Christmas throughout the United States. And you know, it started just as a tuba player. His name was Harvey Phillips, and he played the tuba. He was a tuba teacher, and he was just passionate about the tuba. I think one of the neat things that Tuba Christmas does is it gives a voice to an instrument and a set of instruments and musicians who don't always get to be in the forefront of an ensemble.
Yeah, it's sort of the
exactly. So to go, you know, to go from that in the oompas to you know, getting to play the melody and getting to sit in the front of the stage and kind of be the star, this is a really rare opportunity, and I think, you know, one that they embrace heavily.
Are you a tuba player?
I am not. I am a clarinetist by trade, but I have learned to love the tuba.
What do you love about it? You know, just celebrate the tuba
for a minute. Celebrate the tuba. You know what I love? I love the tuba players and the persona of a tuba player. I mean, I feel like if you imagine what a tuba player might be, like whether it's a high school tuba player or, you know, a guy who's retired and is picking up his tuba after 30 years – they may not look the same, but they have the same persona. They're just, you know, just really fun, just exciting people, I think.
Cool. Well, so tell me about the upcoming performance happening this year. You've already had one performance, and then there's another one tomorrow night?
That's tomorrow at noon.
Oh, tomorrow at noon.
So this week total, between this past Monday and tomorrow, we'll have just around 800 players. We've moved back to our home in the Kauffman Center in Hellsburg Hall. So tomorrow at noon, we'll have 400 tuba players on stage playing all sorts of Christmas carols and just having a great time.
How do you go from, like, your standard crew of 400 or so to like 800 for that world record? Where do you find 800 tuba players? I have to know this.
Well, we'll have 800 total this week. We had 400 on Monday, 400 tomorrow.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How do you find that many tuba players in one city?
They're here. And I think that's what's exciting is that, you know, like they're here and they want to play and they want to make music together.
Our time is up, but Stephanie Brimhall, thank you so much for telling us all about this Tuba Christmas experience.
My pleasure.
The next Tuba Christmas performance is Friday, tomorrow, at the Kauffman Center at noon. That is a wrap for today. Everything from the show will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we will have people from great restaurants in Kansas City giving you tips for when you have people in your home this holiday season. So tune in tomorrow at 10 for that experience on KCUR's Central Standard. The show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.